Okay. Are we on? Yes? Okay, now we are. The volume isn't on this. Hello. You can hear me, right? Good. They can hear me. Welcome to the last 3 days of classes. Can you believe it? Yeah. The fifth assignments and the last writing assignment exercise and some old stuff are down on the table. They'll still be there after. And Talia has some comments about the writing exercise and the assignment.
Thank you. All right, so you've gotten all of your papers back. It was fun grading. So I really appreciate all the work that you did. I actually really appreciated the creativity of the rules. They were really great, and I really loved some people really brought their voice into it, which I really appreciated. A couple of things. I think everybody generally did really well. If you're a little bit concerned about your grade, don't worry. And also, it's not out of 100, so you can't really equate it. So if you got like a 30 out of 40, you can't really change that into out of 100. So it's points for points. So don't worry about that part. I looked for references and explanations of how Bronfenbrenner would support your rules. And I also looked for, if you made mention of the other articles, how they connect with Bronfenbrenner and how that would be developmentally facilitating. I made sure to note the use of the rules for roles, activities, and relations and connecting them to multiple systems and settings. If you mentioned the macro system bonus, that was great and really appreciated how the macro system influenced the idea of your rules. I got tripped up on some people's mechanics and use of grammar, so that made that brought down some people's points. I was looking for clarity and your ability to convey the information that you wanted to give. I really was trying to be flexible in terms of understanding where you're coming from in terms and how you're explaining your rules, but if there was significant problems with grammar mechanics, it was hard to fully understand. But overall, they looked really great. If you have questions, if you can't read my handwriting, let me know. If you have read all over your paper, it doesn't mean that I thought it was horrible. It just means that I had a lot of feedback and I had a lot of questions. And maybe something that somebody said made me think about something more and it might be interesting to look further into and just kind of food for thought. So don't get caught up on that. The in-class, looking at the ideas of how your relationship changes, again, using power, reciprocity, affect, the idea of changes in communication, and connecting the changes in relationships to Bronfenbrenner and not just personal anecdotes. Does anybody have any questions for me right now? I'll be hanging around after class a little bit if you have questions for me.
Thank you, Talia. Okay, the review session schedule and the final exam schedule are up there. And the other thing we have is distribution of points at this point. There. And, sorry, I have to, the monitor's not working, so I have to come out here to see what I have. Oh, there we go. So the top score is, I'm not sure, I think it's 129.5, okay. And then these are probably people who aren't with us anymore. So that's what we have, and then after the exam there'll be another one of those, except it'll be longer, more spread out. The question that some of you have in your mind is, what does that mean grade-wise? And if I had to assign grades on the basis of this, which I don't, but if this is what I had, and we weren't going to have a final exam, I don't want to start rumors, we will have a final exam on Friday. But if I were going to do this, that cluster would be A's. This cluster would probably be B's, maybe, yeah, B's of some sort. The B's might fall down into there. These would be C's. And everybody who takes everything and does all the assignments will pass. Okay. So if you have done everything and you take the final exam, you will pass. I didn't say that at the beginning, did I? It's not on the syllabus. I do that in five. Would you remind me to put that on the syllabus for this course too? If you do all the work, you will pass the course, so you don't need to be anxious about that part of it. Okay? Everything that has been graded is in this. I think there are a couple of papers that came in late that haven't been graded, but that's it. So everything but the final is there. Other questions? Okay, we're going to have some fun today, I hope. And I left you with a question on Wednesday that we were going to try applying developcology to some more or less typical, hopefully not quite typical, but some occasionally encountered family situations. And the one I left you with on Wednesday was what? Do you remember? Someday, somebody should do a research project on how much that gets said in the last 2 minutes of class actually gets absorbed and remembered. Because my guess is it drops off precipitously in the last 2 minutes, probably. Anyway, the question I left you with was, what happens to the ecosystem when one parent has an affair? And it's not discovered. Okay, so we have a secret affair going on. So obviously you spent the last 5 days thinking about that. Great cocktail party conversation over the weekend. Or not, as the case might be. What happens to the ecosystem? When somebody has an affair. An affair in this case is having a sexual relationship with somebody to whom one is not married while one is still married to somebody who thinks that you are being more or less faithful. I just made that up. Brian?
I guess the communication between the parents gets a little, like there's not as much communication, and that directs the parents' relationship with one another, and through that it could affect the children's relationship with the parents.
So the relation does what?
I'd say they stop communicating less, or whoever's having an affair would try and avoid the other person to a greater extent so as to not have to, get into it.
I'm sorry?
A role change.
A role change?
Like a loving, like faithful husband, like
non-faithful. We're talking about the wife here.
Oh.
Gotcha. Okay. So somebody changes his or her role, but the complementary role of the other spouse presumably does not change because the other person doesn't know this is going on. Right? So within the relation, as far as one party is concerned, there's no role change. The other party is probably very much aware of the role change, and we might speculate is trying very hard to play out the role of spouse in a way that is not different. So there may be more self-consciousness about that, but an attempt to try to stay in role as far as the other partner is concerned. Other thoughts about how the ecosystem is going to change? Colleen.
It's large because
okay, there's a new relation. That the infidelitous one, is that a word, is involved with. Probably a new setting or a different setting. Maybe. New molar activity. It's not a shared setting for the cheatee, the person who is not involved in the affair. So, not a setting in that person's mesosystem. So from the standpoint of the spouse, it's an exosystem setting. And the person who is having the affair is spending more time in that setting than prior to the affair, and less time in other settings, presumably, which might include work, home, recreation. So the person having the affair has expanded his or her roles, is engaged in more relations, probably more complex. Expanded the mesosystem, the roles, relations. So this ought to be good, right? That person's ecosystem is affording him or her more relationships, wider variety of roles, more complex molar activities, broader view, different view of the ecosystem he or she lives in. So this is good, right? What if they're not compatible? They're probably not compatible. What's that's going to What is that going to do? Okay. And generally increases stress when roles are incompatible. There is probably not goal consensus between the two settings if you knew that the other person was having an affair. You would probably not agree to that, so there would be not be agreement. Who's not supporting? Okay, the settings are not supportive of each other. Okay, so probably trying to avoid having this new setting become part of his obvious and visible mesosystem. So he's probably isolating that setting, not taking his best friends, not taking his children, her children, their children, its children. So not connecting that setting to other parts of the ecosystem where it might be discovered that the affair is happening. So it's not going to become a richly linked setting in the ecosystem for the cheater, and it's going to be even less connected for the cheatee. Okay. So the ecosystem has gotten a little more complex, but this is not a setting that is likely to be supportive of other settings. It's not likely to be richly connected. So there's a degree of isolation and typically clandestineness about this setting. Okay, does that all kind of make sense? And the fact that the roles are not compatible means that in the home setting with the spouse, there may be some interference. It's an exosystem setting, right, that may interfere with the spousal relationship in the home microsystem because of the need for secrecy, for withholding information, for not being fully reciprocal in sharing information about what might be going on in one's life. And it may also involve deception about your activities and other settings and where you have been. So what you're portraying in the spousal relationship may be an invalid view of the rest of your ecosystem, at least that portion of it. Okay. So we have not talked about that, but it's one of the implications that you are in a relationship, in any kind of relationship, you are to greater or lesser degree describing and reflecting the rest of your ecosystem to the other person. Okay. And ideally that would be happening reciprocally, but in the case of having an affair, you're not going to be presenting that ecosystem validly. You're going to be leaving out parts of your life, parts of your ecosystem, at least that one setting. You may be engaging in activities that are quite important to you, but you're not describing those to your spouse. So when we talk about the difficulty in the relationship, part of it is that you're not presenting your full ecosystem validly in the spousal relationship or in the partner relationship. That's what secrets are about. Some part of my ecosystem is not shared. Okay. And when we think about intimacy in a relationship and we think about trust, we think about full communication. One way to think about that is that we are presenting a valid and differentiated view of the world we live in to the other person. And if there are parts of that that you can't share, then you limit the full reciprocity, the full intimacy, the full disclosure. Anytime you can't talk about what's going on in your ecosystem, there are many other situations where that happens. An affair is not unique. Some people have jobs they can't talk about. One of my best friends is a CIA analyst. And he says one of the things he loves about his job is that he can only do it at work. Period. He can't talk about it with anybody else. It is an isolated setting. And his wife loves it because he comes home and says, I had a stressful day. That's it. That's all he can say. And that's what it's been for the last 25 years for them. He occasionally gives her hints. And then after something comes down, then he can tell her what he did. But not while it's going on. And it's fun knowing your valid view of your ecosystem is that you know your phone is tapped. It's okay. You just live with that. You know they probably read your emails. It's okay. You just be careful what you say. An affair might be the same. Engaging in illegal activities, perhaps the same. You don't tell your family that you're doing that. Okay? But the long-term impact of that, particularly in the case of an affair, may be that you develop the habit of not fully disclosing what's going on in your life to your partner. And so you may be giving information that's not quite valid. You may be depriving the partner of being able to support you. What happens when you have a falling out with the person you're having an affair with and you're all stressed and angry about that and you go home? But your spouse, your family don't know about it, so how can they be supportive? They just figure you're going off the deep end. Okay? That seem reasonable? Now, theoretically, you can do that kind of developmental analysis, looking at the effects on the ecosystem of any kind of involvement that a person has, any kind of change in the family. So let's look at a transition now. We're going to have an ecological transition here. The spouse just found out. Now what happens? Now this affair is known. What happens? Not right away. You might get killed, but you don't get divorced right away. That takes time. Okay, the power, the reciprocity, the affect. How many times do you suppose people celebrate the fact that their partner is having an affair? I do know cases where that has happened. And the line goes like this. It's not actually the affect in the relationship, but it's close. The line goes like this. One of them confesses to the other that he or she's been having an affair. The spouse goes, thank you. I'm out of here. And gets happy. Having been waiting for the spouse to make that kind of stupid act, and now has a grounds and an excuse, and everybody will be sympathetic, rather than just walking away from a marriage that isn't working. You wait till the spouse has an affair, and then it's all justified. So you get happy. Okay, the power gets out of whack in what way? What happens now?
Probably in favor of the spouse that wasn't cheating.
Okay, the spouse that wasn't cheating Or there may be a sudden struggle for power. And that's something else that we have not talked about. We've talked about changes in the power in relationship and trying to find a comfortable balance. But at certain times when there's an ecological transition of this sort, power is suddenly up for grabs. And people suddenly want it all. So in most cases where there is an affair and it's found out, there is a sudden grab to try to establish power over the other person, to establish your bargaining position, to threaten the other person, to control the other person's behavior, to take back the balance and make it less balanced so that you have it. So the power tends to get negotiated. And think about the ways people do that. Threat, I just mentioned. Okay. Promises, sometimes. Power grab. One of the ways you get power in a relationship is to immediately tell the children that the other parent is totally untrustworthy. You try to triangulate, get more people involved, get the other people on your side so that you can gang up on the offender. You clean out the bank account. You get a lawyer to be on your side. Or, what else happens when you find out that a partner is having an affair? Sometimes people relinquish their power entirely. They simply collapse. They can't function. They become depressed. They feel powerless, helpless, devastated, betrayed, all of those things. But they don't know how to get the power. It's not comfortable for them to threaten or grab power, so they become victims and become powerless. Temporarily. And so the relation is going to change. The affect went where? The affect usually within the couple relationship hits the bottom. And then the couple is dealing with very negative affect, dealing with the anger that comes along with that. And then move toward reciprocity in accusations, blame, fault-finding, complaint, criticism, all of those things that, in the middle of which people are likely to say things that will never, ever, ever be forgotten and often never forgiven. So the relationship is at risk dramatically at that point, because the affect may be irretrievably negative. What happens to the roles? Role becomes public, and the cheated on spouse becomes a cheated on spouse. That's a role change for the spouse. And part of his or her behavior in that situation is likely to be consistent with his or her interpretation of what is appropriate in that role. In some cultures, that role comes along with the right to kill the other person and his or her lover. Often you have to find them in order to do that, or you have to catch them. But in some cultures you have the cuckolded husband role, or the betrayed wife role. And you can kill the partner, sometimes you can kill the lover, and not go to jail. It's simply considered an act of honor, righting a wrong that's been done, and it's okay. And no court will convict you for doing that. In patriarchal cultures where if the wife is having an affair, the husband has the right to kill her and her lover. One of the things you want to think about before you have an affair with somebody who's married is how you want to die. The advice I often give people is just make sure, do you really want to die at the hands of a really angry husband or wife? Is that the way you want to go? Have that on your tombstone. Shot by an angry husband. Probably not the way you want to go. So the roles change. Now you have a public offender role. You have a betrayed spouse role. And those are likely to be defined by anger. Retaliation. If you are the betrayed spouse, what I've been describing is retaliation. You may kill the other person. You may, let's see, we already talked about waiting to exhale, right? You can cut the arms off his sleeves and throw his suits in the BMW and light it on fire. That's retaliation for the offense. One of my, I love, car stories are great. You've probably heard this one. It was in Reader's Digest a number of years ago, so it's a real story. Woman advertised an almost new, I think it was Corvette, almost new Corvette for sale for some ridiculous figure, like $1,000, $500, I don't remember what it was. And immediately got several offers, sold it, and the person who bought it was very curious. You know, there doesn't seem to be anything wrong with this car. It's relatively new. Why are you essentially giving it away? Oh, well, my husband left me, and when we talked about dividing the property, he told me to sell the car and send him the money. That's retaliation. What happens in the setting where the affair has been happening? It becomes a known setting, an exosystem setting that you become aware of, one that has now ruined your relationship or put a big dent in it. You become aware of its impact. Now you get to try to develop a valid view of the impact of what went on in that setting on you and your development and the microsystem that you're in. So many people, when they find out that an affair has been going on, want to know who, when, how, where, all of those questions. How did you cover it up? You know, when were you there? And then you begin to reinterpret past history as you try to take into account the spouse's activities that you were unaware of. And so you begin to figure out, okay, was he really working? Why haven't we had money? Why have I not seen all of the visa bills recently? All of those sorts of things. And so you begin to reassess your view of your ecosystem and try to come to terms with the impact of the ecosystem setting, the exosystem setting on you. You have a new dyad, enlarging your world. You have a new dyadic relation with the other person. Likely to be not very positive. Likely to not have positive affect in it. likely to be a little angry. So one of the things that people do is try to establish contact with that person. And they show up on the doorstep. I understand you've been having an affair with my spouse. That generally generates negative affect and anxiety when that happens. And then there are activities defined by the roles. Now you're aware that there's another role. And this is a person with whom you have a complementary role. How do you deal with the person that your spouse has been having an affair with? What's the most hurtful kind of affair that you're aware of? When are they hardest to accept? I'm sorry?
When it's a family friend.
Make it worse. When it's your sister. Ooh. Okay, that's a tough one. When the affair is happening within the family. Her best friend or his best friend. Okay, best friends. Probably the hardest affairs to deal with, because you not only then lose your relationship, particularly if it moves in the direction toward divorce, you lose the stability and happiness and all of that of your marriage, but you also are likely to have lost your best friend. And some people who are in that situation play the game of trying to figure out which is actually worse. Is it worse to lose my wife or my best friend? And the combination, of course, is devastating. There was another hand. Yes? Right. When you go through that next set of transitions and you get divorced and the person ends up marrying your best friend, and you know, then the whole larger social ecosystem may be uncomfortable to the max as you try to figure out, you know, which side you're going to be on and which friends you can give up and which of your friends are real friends because they ostracize your former partner and your former best friend, and which ones aren't your real friends because they accept. So your ecosystem in that case may be really messed up for a while as you try to figure out where you can be comfortable and where you can't. And also as you start to figure out who else knew about this and didn't tell you. Couples who stay together? Yeah. What happens to them? What happens to them? Here they are. They're going through this. What would you want to have happen or expect to have happen if they're going to stay together? It happens. There are books on it. There are therapists who specialize in helping couples figure out whether they can stay together after an affair. How do you raise the affect back up into the positive zone? How do you recreate reciprocity and trust, which isn't part of Bronfenbrenner's term, but where? How do you establish, can we translate Bronfenbrenner, can we translate trust into Bronfenbrenner? Reciprocally presenting your activities and your ecosystem validly without hiding anything, so that you are predictable and that the other person can trust that you are presenting your activities, your view of the world and your activities in it completely. Is that trust? Probably. Yeah. And it typically takes a long time when couples decide they can do that. Would it help if they were equal in power? It helps if they have both had affairs. And one of the ways betrayed spouses reestablish a degree of equality and reciprocity and equal power is to deliberately go have an affair. Let's see, what movie was that in? Long time ago. There's this terribly awful, wonderful, terrible scene. Oh, The Unbearable Lightness of Being. The wife, the woman whose husband has had multiple affairs, decides that she needs to know what this is about. So she goes out and chooses somebody to have sex with, and it's, you want to see really bad sex and a really bad relationship. Go watch that. Exactly how not to do it if you're going to have an affair, I think. And she's establishing reciprocity. She's trying to understand what this process is about, what it means to have an affair, so that she can have a more valid view of his behavior. She doesn't get it in that particular movie. Therapists will tell you that if you're going to stay together, you have a choice. You either completely cut off the relationship with the lover, or the lover has to be included in therapy. It's okay if you choose not to do that, but we need to operate with the three of you. And if that person has a partner, then the four of you, if you're going to continue the affair, that's the only way the therapist will work. You've got to have everybody in the room, which usually ends up either cutting that setting out of the ecosystem entirely or ending therapy and the marriage. You can't do that. If you're not willing to do that, then goes away. Other thoughts about how you might want to manage your ecosystem in order to keep the couple together? Who else should know about the affair? Tell your kids, tell your family, tell your friends. None of the above. None of the above. If a couple is going to stay together, it's helpful for them not to share that information with anybody, because it begins to change the ecosystem for both of them if other people know. It's best if it helps. It's best if it's something that is between the two and they decide that they want to keep their marriage together and put it back together in a positive way. It helps if nobody else is now upset. Children tend not to take their parents' affairs gracefully. They tend not to want to know. They tend to deal with it badly. So it's best if they don't know. So if you want to keep it together, make it just a private affair between the two people and immediately begin to work with a therapist who's experienced in doing that. So you need to expand your ecosystem to include a professional who has experience and can help you with the communication and the process of deciding that you want to keep the relationship together and that you want to restore it to be a healthy relationship. The probability is not great. The probability is not great. Less than half of couples who enter therapy to see if they can put the marriage back together, succeed in doing so. It may take them a while. They may divorce more amicably because they've talked about it, but it's a very difficult process to put back together, to put the marriage back together. Then we divorce. So the next transition is divorce. Some of you have experience with that. And again, we can describe it in terms of what happens to the ecosystem as you go from having one microsystem to having two microsystems. Separation means moving into a different setting. So the two partners now live in separate places. They begin to take apart their shared ecosystem and figure out which settings they can continue to share, which relationships they can continue to share, and which ones they don't want to share, and in many cases begin to establish new relationships in new settings that are not shared, which now are not part of the mesosystem of the partner, though they may become part of the exosystem of the former partner. This process happens all the time. When people break up, people separate, people divorce, and it's really easy. It's just, okay, you break it up, unless you have children. That complicates it. So if you're going to break up, if you're going to end a marriage, do it before you have children. It's just much easier. You can have couples who've been married 8-10 years, no kids. They divorce. They never have to see each other. Once they finish the legal process and divide the property, they never have to communicate with each other. They never have to see each other again. It's just a piece of cake. You know, they may share custody of the dog until it dies, but, and I've probably mentioned in here, I have a friend who shares the custody of the dog with her former husband. The dog moves back and forth every 4 to 6 months. They transport the dog. The dog goes through a period of transition, anxiety and problem, and settling down to the new routine. It takes about 4 days. The dog is kind of unpredictable for 3 or 4 days in the new setting. Then he settles down. He's okay. All right. As long as the food dish came with me, as long as I've got a bone, I'm fine. Just like kids, right? Same way kids do if you shift them back and forth. No, kids don't do it that easily. Okay. When you have children, the roles and the relationships and what you've created as now a home mesosystem become much more complex, particularly from the point of view of the developing person, the child, in that situation. So what happens developologically is that the child's ecosystem, home microsystem, becomes a home mesosystem. The ecosystem gets more complex. And for many kids, this is actually, in the long run, as you would expect from Bronfenbrenner, this is positive. They come out with a better view of the world, more skills in dealing with the world because they have had more experience in dealing with a variety of settings and a variety of roles as they were growing up. They've also often had relationships where they had more power, relationships with parents where they had more power than they would have had they stayed in an intact couple setting. because they're dealing with parents who, at least for a period of time, may not be terribly competent. And in order to survive, kids whose parents are divorcing often become more competent in some areas than they would have had the opportunity to be if they had stayed in the original microsystem. So if you think about it developmentologically, although it's a problem for many kids, that problem may have positive outcomes. If you look at the process of divorce and its consequences, the general results are that in this country, and it's similar in England, those are the only two that I have good data about, that I've reviewed the literature on, that after a few years, women are more competent, confident, skilled, emotionally mature, and feel their self-concepts generally are more positive than they were during the marriage. So, like many other things, divorce may be good for women, and they learn to cope with it, and they do well. So you have Hetherington's summary of lessons that she learned that comes from a book called For Better or For Worse, in which she describes her 40 years of research on divorcing couples and families. And Hetherington concludes, as does just about everybody else who looks at it, that while women may be depressed, while women may have financial problems, after a while, they gather their resources, they gather their supportive relationships, and deal. And they often deal quite well. The general result being that their self-concepts, their competence, their ability to deal with the world increases as a result of coping with the divorce. Men do much less well, generally. Men have more problems as a result of divorce, and the long-term consequences are likely to be more negative for them, particularly in the areas of mental health and relationships. Okay. And that sometimes is attributed to the fact that men don't have good emotional skills, and often deal with the losses that come about as a result of divorce, loss of contact with children or less involvement in children's lives, more necessity to do more activities that they've not practiced and aren't very good at, like feeding themselves and maintaining a household. Men often have difficulty with those and become depressed. And some men deal with their depression and their disappointment and their anger in ways that are not good for them with drinking. So health issues are more likely in men than in women. Depression is more common in women, but that's generally true. Men deal with their depression in ways that are not healthy, so they're likely to have more mental health problems. They're more likely to abuse alcohol. They're more likely to get involved in, not that women don't, but that men are more likely to get involved in relationships that are not healthy, that increase their stress, that increase their sense of not being able to deal well in the world, and that leads to isolation, and increased depression and often more alcohol abuse. What about kids? Kids are experiencing this more complex home. Now it's a mesosystem, binuclear family. They went from the nuclear family to the binuclear family, which means it has two nuclei. Two nucleuses, mom and dad. What happens to the children is pretty much predictable by what happens between the parents. And people like Hetherington suggest that if you want to know how well the kids are going to turn out as a result of, or how they're going to be affected by the divorce of their parents, look at how the parents are doing themselves. And if the parents are having problems coping, and particularly if there's continued conflict between the parents, the kids will not be doing well. If parents cope well, and if they resolve their conflicts and figure out how to be civil with each other in a relatively short period of time, then the kids will do pretty well. There are no long-term consequences of divorce for kids whose parents divorce well. Parents often ask, how long will my children be upset? And how long will they have problems because of the divorce? And the answer to that is, they will stop having problems about the time the parents stop having problems. So when you figure out how you're going to communicate with each other and manage parenting and get the finances resolved and get into a stable situation for both parents without conflict between them, without open conflict between them. You can still hate each other if you want, but without open conflict between them. Then, at about that point, the kids will decide to go with the flow and they'll get back on track developmentally. Other thoughts about the ecosystem changes that come along with parental divorce? Other relationships? People who get divorced are available for new relationships. They start dating again, sometimes, eventually. So their ecosystems expand by adding new romantic relationships. Or one of you suggested that it would be difficult if the divorce happened because there was a lover and then that lover becomes the stepmother, father, stepparent in the household. The probability of that happening and that relationship surviving is low. Many people do live with people they have had an affair with, but those relationships are low probability of success. Not impossible, but low probability. Divorce rate is about 48% for first marriages. A little higher if you have children. Children cause an increase in the divorce rate. Okay, stress. The divorce rate for second marriages is higher, and it's higher if there are stepchildren involved. And the highest divorce rate is for remarriages when there are stepchildren involved, when the remarriage is between people who had an affair before the end of the first marriage, the previous marriage. So, translate that into planning for your own life. You want to increase the probability of divorce as high as it can possibly go. Marry somebody you've had an affair with while that person was still married, and when one or both of you have children to bring to the second marriage. And then every once in a while you read about that success story where people actually did it and it works and they stay together for 50 years and they have a wonderful marriage, and there's no accounting for that. But statistically it's a low probability, so don't count on it, no matter what the other person tells you. So, when you bring another person into the microsystem. So now we have a parent, we have a step parent, we have children of the original mother in this case that we were talking about. When the step parent brings children and a dog, then you create a complex family microsystem which often has complex relationships with the other family microsystem, with dad and his new partner and the new partner's children and pets. And a former spouse. Oh yeah, we've got another spouse here we need to bring into. So what happens is, as you start making those changes, is that home becomes binuclear, so there are two physical settings. You spend time in each one. Each of those has a person in the parent role and perhaps a person in the unmarried, almost step-parent role, who is also in a parent role to his or her own children and has a more or less complex relationship with his or her children's other parent, who has a new partner, who has a complex relationship. You can see what's happening, is that the family becomes a mesosystem with more or less conflictful relationships and with unequal relationships and roles within that family microsystem. Parents are not equal to step-parents. One's own children do not have the same relationship typically with you as your stepchildren have. The microsystem has relationships that are more or less conflictful as children move back and forth between the setting, whichever one you're looking at, and their other setting. And the stepchildren in the situation may have conflictful relationships with their other setting. So life gets complex. And it's interesting to try to draw the ecosystem and look at the number of roles and the opportunity for conflict within that role, within those roles. So we end up with children and stepchildren, siblings, step-siblings. Oh, then let's have some more of our own. So we have new children who are actually the biological children of both parents now living in the setting. So you have three child roles, his, hers, and ours, and those all have complex relationships with each other with potential for inequality, for lack of reciprocity, for differential treatment by the adults in the family. So the bottom line recommendation is just don't get married, don't have kids. No, just, it's easier that way. Until you're ready to deal with all of that. One of the things that helps parents, particularly as they divorce, is to understand the complexity of what they're creating and how they can make that even more complex with its multiple potentials for conflict. And then to think about what is going to happen to the children as you go through each of the series of changes that are likely to happen in their ecosystem over the next rest of their lives with new grandparents, step-grandparents, with extended family. Once you recognize that you may be overloading the child with ecological transitions, new roles, new dyadic relationships, new settings, changes in the relationships between settings, then you can begin to see that the parents have a major responsibility to help children deal with the changes that are taking place. A divorce is not a, it's not an incident, it's not an act. Divorce is a process. and it goes on and on and on. And ecologically, it's a series of transitions then that begin with conflict between the parents, whatever its source, and then as each change happens for each parent and for the kids, each new relationship is added, you're still coping with what was initiated perhaps even before the divorce action took place. Divorce has many aspects, and they don't have to be done in a particular order, but each of them involves changes in the ecosystem. Questions or confusions or thoughts, experiences? Okay, let me look at how divorce has changed briefly. We have been changing the way we deal with divorce for the last century at least, and more. The macro system changes. One of the challenges in dealing with divorce is that some of us live in a different era than others, and some of us have difficulty keeping up with what is happening to divorce in the macro system. We've seen major changes over the last 60 years in the way we do it and its meaning. We've changed the way we construct divorce and the way we deal with it. Back in the 1920s, before women had the vote, divorce was extremely difficult. You had to have a very alcoholic and or very abusive or very adulterous spouse to provide grounds for divorce. So people didn't as easily. If they divorced, custody was easy. It went to the father. So men always got custody, except in extremely rare circumstances, because when they divorced, since women couldn't vote, couldn't sign contracts, didn't own property, when they divorced, they were the ones who lost. And fathers were the heads of the households. They owned the property. They kept the property after divorce. Divorce settlements were fairly rare. In some cases, women were permitted to keep property that they had inherited from their own families of origin, but fathers got custody. And then women got the vote, and they got the right to inherit property, and gradually they got the right to sign contracts without their husband's permission, do all kinds of things without husbands. And it became more common for them to be able to divorce. And because of Freud and other folks, we began to change our view of children. It wasn't just financial support that children needed. They needed their mothers. And so in the 1920s and 30s, we began to develop an attitude in the law, which was called the Tender Years Doctrine, which is that young children should be with their mothers. So unless a woman was declared unfit, she would get custody. And that accelerated and became the norm up into the 1960s, when it began to change again. Meantime, men, we were really good guys. We got rid of the children because children needed their mothers, but we kept the money. So what we had earned, what we had paid for, the property was ours. So we did this wonderful scam for about 30 years when women got the kids, men got the property, and the result of that was a steady increase in the number of women and children going below the poverty limit. And back in the 60s and 70s, the most common reason for women to enter the ranks of poverty was divorce and having custody of the children. In the meantime, men's disposable income increased after divorce. They had the money, and now they didn't have to share it. They sometimes had to provide alimony if they were really bad, and they often had to provide child support, but not very much, and it wasn't based on income in the majority of cases. So we changed that, and that was a huge macro system change. Until the 1980s, by 1980, most states had adopted or were in the process of adopting no-fault divorce, which meant you could just say, we don't get along, we have irreconcilable differences, we can't live together. So either party could initiate a divorce. Women have always initiated more divorces than men. That's been a steady thing. Still, even if men want a divorce, the women act faster and initiate it. And about that same time, we began to change the child support laws toward greater equity on the assumption that all of the money that came into a marriage was equally the property of both man and woman. And that's the way most states deal with support now and division of property. Even no matter who earned it, it was marital property and it gets divided down the middle. And I still hear echoes of men screaming about that because they made more money, therefore they should get more money out of the divorce, forgetting that when they took those vows, it implied that they were going to support each other. And when they signed the wedding license, the marriage license, the state assumed now that everything belonged to both of them equally, now and in the future. We'll pick up from there and talk about these other macro system changes on Wednesday.